Blog Talk Radio.
All right, so this is our mic. Okay.
This is Jill Larson on Star Dish Radio. Tune in and stay tuned. You never know who will drop by.
Hey guys, welcome to Stardust Radio. I am Brandon from Brandon's Buzz. You've probably already figured out that I'm not Joanne. Joanne is having some technical difficulties tonight. As many of you know, she's moving from Buffalo back down to Florida. And anyway, she's having some problems with that move, and so she asked me to take the reins tonight at the last minute, so here I am. I hope you're not too disappointed. We're going to have some fun tonight anyway. We've got a great guy on the phone here, and you know we're going to dive right in. My guest tonight is definitely an actor on the rise. He's taken on a number of high-profile roles in such theater classics as Hair and A Few Good Men, and he's worked steadily in primetime and in film over the past decade, but he's found his greatest success, at least of late, on daytime television, where he is currently setting the town of Landview, PA, on fire with his terrific work as attorney Elijah Clark on ABC's One Life to Live. And he's come by the buzz tonight. He's come by the show tonight. The buzz. I'm already saying the buzz. It's Stardish. He's come by Stardish tonight to tell us all about it. You know, this guy's a fabulous actor, and he's got a fascinating story. And I ask you all to give a warm Stardish welcome to the terrific Matt Walton.
Hey, everybody.
How you doing, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you tonight?
Doing very well. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
Thanks for coming to hang out for a little bit and chat about this, that, and the other.
Absolutely. So where do we start?
Well, let's set the table here. Give me the 60-second bio on Matt Walton. Where were you born? Where were you raised? Where did you go to school? Stuff out of the way.
I am a Jersey boy, born and raised near the Delaware Water Gap, out toward the Pennsylvania border in farmland. My first job was actually on a farm. And then went to high school out there and then found my way into performing arts early, actually. My mother got me started in it when I was just a little kid. And I think it was a production of Peter Pan. I played John, and I just had the pleasure of taking my five-year-old daughter to see a production of Peter Pan here in New Jersey at the Paper Mill Playhouse. So,
excellent.
The circles of life go on and on. So, and then in high school, I ended up going to this performing arts school at night, and then I got a scholarship to the Boston Conservatory, also where Mark Lawson from the show went to school.
Oh, wow, okay.
And from there, moved to New York. I started working in Boston, where one of my jobs there was playing Scott Evans's father, another cast member on the show. So I'm very close with their family.
It really is a small world.
It really, really is. And then moved to New York and never had to go to L.A. because I started working in voiceovers. I kind of always looked about 7 years older than I actually am, and so I had to wait till I was in my 30s to really get any on-camera work, and I've found plenty of opportunities behind the camera during that time, just building up the necessary skill sets. You know, and in New York, it's such a lot smaller of a market than L.A., so you're forced to diversify, and, you know, one of the things you get access to is the soaps, and here we are.
Absolutely.
Was that longer than 60 seconds?
Not at all.
Okay, good.
You know, it sounds like you kind of always knew you wanted to be an actor. Is that fair?
You know, I didn't always know I wanted to be an actor. It was always something that I did well at. You know, it was something that just came naturally to me, talking to people or pretend. I was very much into, you know, Star Wars opened up my imagination when I was 4 years old. I saw that movie and it was very intense about playing with my toys. And I'd get into characters, you know, the characters of my action figures, you know. And so when it came time to just be a flying monkey in The Wizard of Oz or, you know, what was some of those other things I did? I can't even remember. Oh, I actually played Punjab in Annie, of course. That's the African-American role. And I was in full blackface for that at the age of 9. But it was just, you know, that was a little tidbit. But it came naturally to me. So when it came time to decide on a career, my mind had pretty much made itself up without me having to, you know, think too hard about it.
Excellent. Don't you wish it could always be that easy?
Don't think for a minute it was easy. You know, it was either that or, you know, you reach these milestones in your life where you're just like, okay, now, here's where I have to decide what I want to be when I grow
Absolutely.
Up, you know, at 18. So and that was one thing at our graduation. I recall our valedictorian said, we are one of the only, this is at the Boston Conservatory, said we're the only classes graduating this year whose major was never undecided, you know, which I thought was pretty pretty accurate and
wow.
profound at the time. Yeah, you know, it's something you're born to do.
Sure.
So there you go.
You know, you mentioned growing up on a farm. I live in Texas. I don't know if you knew that or not. And, you know, we have all kinds of farms here, but you don't think of farms in Jersey of all places. Tell me about growing up on a Jersey farm.
You don't think about farms. Well, farmland, to be fair, my father was the small-town lawyer. And, of course, everyone's like, oh, well, your dad's a lawyer. You must be rich. And I kept trying to figure out why people kept saying that to me, because it didn't seem to be the case. Not that we were struggling or anything, but we were just, you know, normal middle-class folks in the rural parts of New Jersey, which you think about, you know, the big joke is, hey, what exit are you off of?
Sure.
Well, you'd have to get off of exit 151 and then travel another straight hour across Route 78 toward Pennsylvania. Then get off, you know, it's a long way out there. But there wasn't much to do growing up. There really, really wasn't. You could go to the skating rink, you go to the bowling alley, or you could go to the movies. And when I was growing up, there were just a couple movie theaters. And at the time, the multiplex showed two movies,
okay.
I remember. And then,
But when you were a kid, what else do you need? I mean,
well, I don't know. I always yearned for more. I always had my eye on you know, the towns where there were more people and more choices and more things to do. You know, that's kind of what I was pining for out there. But it was, it turns out that the town produced an array of talented people. A couple of us in show business, actually, one of the kid who was a class above me has three daytime Emmys, four or five probably, for producing Rosie O'Donnell show, and he's doing Rachel Ray right now. He did Tony Danza before that, and Wayne Brady before that. He was one guy, and then there was another guy from our town who ended up, his name's Dave Sheridan. He ended up becoming a pretty famous comedic actor out in L.A. He kind of followed in the shoes of Jim Carrey. He was kind of a wacky dude. He had a film career going. He still does, and you know, so we all were sort of reaching for the stars, if that's not too cheesy to say.
Absolutely not. So what would you call your big break? What was the thing that kind of really set you on your path?
Out in New Jersey, well, let's see, set me on my path to becoming an actor, or set me on my path to being able to raise a family on an actor's income?
Sure.
Yeah. Let's see. It's hard to say if there's any one big thing. Series, especially because it took me a while to break in, you know, there's a series of things. One thing, tiny baby steps, one led to the next, to the next, to the next. And I think when I finally, I will attribute it to All My Children. I was on that show for about 6 months playing the most hideous of villains. You know, you can blow up a mine shaft, kill 11 people, and still be redeemed on a soap. But
absolutely.
If you're an internet predator of a 16-year-old character, there's no redemption there. And so I played this.
You know, it's funny you say that, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you're on a show right now with a character named Todd Manning, who once upon a time was the most despicable person in the history of soaps, basically. And, you know, now he's basically the romantic lead of the show. It's very funny.
Isn't that crazy? And, you know, we were just talking today, Cassie DePava and I were just talking about how lucky Trevor is that he
absolutely.
Gets he can do pretty much anything in any way he wants and get away with it. You know, he's the only character in soapdom that can do that. You know, it's very, very funny you bring that up. But, so I was on All My Children for 6 months, and that sort of finally made me say, oh, okay, I can do this. This is cool. You know, you get to, what's great about working in soaps is you get to you get real-time feedback on your work. You know, you only get maybe 2-3 takes at the most. At the most.
At the most.
They're shooting for one. You know, they're hoping you'll hit it in one. So it's, you know, you can watch the show back only a month later, as opposed to film where it's a year or more before you see your work. You watch the soap about a month later, you remember what you did on those three takes. You remember because you only had three. You can say, oh, they used that one. Okay, well, I turned this way. You know, you could find your way in front of the camera, which as a theater, a classically trained actor, that was a hard transition for me, going from stage to the camera. But the soaps gave you the opportunity to really, you know, polish your skills in that department, which was just a big gift. Plus, it also challenges you to say words that no human being would ever put in a sentence, and convincingly, you know, line after line after line. So it's the best training ground for TV, I think.
Yeah, you know, talk about working in theater. You know, you've built a very impressive resume of stage credits. I was looking over it as I was preparing to speak with you. I mean, you mentioned the differences between theater and television. Talk about them a little bit. Talk about starting out in the theater and then moving on to film, to a filmed medium.
My desire to move to the film medium was strictly financial. I would still be doing theater if I could. It's the difference of seeing a band live and hearing their CD. Some bands are studio bands. Some bands are live bands. But the live ones are unmistakable, and the feeling you share going to see a live band, with it's like I would attribute it to going to church. It's a feast for the senses. You know, there's an experience. You never forget it. You talk about it for years. Whereas that's what doing theater is like. You have that communal experience with the audience. You're getting... You know, it's a joint effort, you know, in the theater. And that is so thrilling as a performer. And going into a studio and shooting a movie, or even shooting a movie on location or whatever the difference with, you know, being in front of the camera is, it's really not up to you. You're just, the pictures tell the story. You just have to, you know, say the words believably and stand in the right place and make sure the light's hitting you and the camera's focused, you know. It's not your medium. It's a director's medium, whereas theater, theater's arguably a writer's medium, but they all are. But theater is much more a performer's or an actor's medium. Because,
sure. I mean, once the curtain goes up, you're in charge.
That's right. That's right. When in TV and film, you are the last piece of the puzzle. Seriously, you are just a talking set piece. I don't mean to sound callous about that, but, you know, it's someone else's story you are hired to tell. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But that said, you know, television has become the modern theater, and, you know, what's nice about doing films is you did it, it's done, it's preserved for life. That time you spent is recorded in story form for people to love or not love or whatever, and you'll always have that. It's cool. It's nice to be able to do both. I try to do about a play a year. The last one I did was last year out in Pittsburgh. It was a play by Keith Radin about plane crash investigators who end up, you know, having their own sort of disastrous affair. And it's just, you know, you check out and you concentrate on this play for 3 months, and you do it, and you get back and your batteries are recharged, and then you can stand in front of the camera and be told what to do and where to look and all that stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are you a theater junkie? I mean, do you go to the theater quite a bit?
Not as much as I'd like to. It's problem with living in New York is you have all of it at your fingertips. It's like
Absolutely.
People who live in California never go to the beach. You know, it's not because, you know, it's just, oh, yeah, I know that's there, or I know the people in it, or I know I can ultimately see it, or I can get the script or whatever. And yeah, I'm kind of embarrassed to say I just don't get to the theater as much as I'd like to. I just don't. And there's a problem, too. It's such a struggling medium. It's very, very, very difficult, even in Manhattan, to put people in an audience. It's difficult to get them to get out of the comforts of their home, especially as, you know, more and more modern technology makes being at home all the more entertaining.
Sure.
You know, going out and dropping $100 on a Broadway show, that's a major event. So the shows people are going to want to see are going to be event shows for the most part. I don't want to generalize, but the audience for the theater is almost as small as the audience for ballet. You know, it's not something that the kids are going to do or going to see. That's why it looks like Broadway is trying to bring the younger generation into its arms in one way or another. So you have Green Day.
Sure.
One of my favorite punk bands from college is now, you know, they're up for best musical on Broadway, you know. Bon Jovi's musical won. One of the guys from Bon Jovi, their musical won this year from Memphis.
Absolutely. You know, I took my first trip to the city a couple of weeks ago and took
really?
A Broadway show for the first time ever, and that was the show I saw in Memphis. And I thought
well, that starred my friend Chad Kimball, who was up for Best Actor. He also went to our college. He was a couple years behind me. Great guy. And Montego Glover, and they probably both deserved to win.
Absolutely. You know, Chad especially, from the moment he steps on stage, he has your full attention. From the moment he appears on stage.
Yeah. And it's an original musical. It's kind of a gift that Broadway doesn't get as much. It's like one guy's idea, and he builds a show around the idea, as opposed to something like Shrek, which is, you know, it's an amusement park ride is what it is. This Memphis is an original musical about something that somebody cared about, and wow, it won. Go figure. You know, it's like, I don't know, I was talking to Trevor St. John, and I think he said this. He says, no work of art has ever been improved by committee or something like that. I thought that was apropos of what's kind of going on here. So, yeah.
Well, I tell you what, we've got a couple of people in line here waiting to speak with you. Do you mind taking a couple of calls?
I would love to.
How about area code 312? If I'm not mistaken, this is my buddy Tony.
Hello.
Tony,
is that you? Hello, hey, Brandon. What's going on? Yeah,
not
Brandon.
Much, man. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good.
They had a Matt Walton. He's right here.
Hey, Matt, what's going on?
Not much, Tony. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. You make myself. I just enjoy you on screen these days with playing Eli opposite the cast of the Pirates, Blair. How's that Design Mag works on screen with you, too?
Well, let me tell you something. I'm going to be completely honest. I had done a day player role a few years back of another Detective Price. Not the one who's in Landview. I was a Detective Price in Chicago, and I got to work with Cassie for, like, you know, 3 hours or whatever. And I was smitten. You know, she is just, I think, and I've always thought, one of the most gorgeous women in the history of television, you know. So I get into One Life to Live last year, and they don't know where my story's going. I'm just supposed to blackmail Taya, you know, and, you know, they're saying, oh, they like you, they might keep you around. No, maybe you'll get a love interest. And I'm like, oh, I hope it's Blair, you know, just joking, but not. And one day, executive producer Frank Valentini comes into the rehearsal hall. I've only been there a couple months. And he goes, points at me and points at Cassie and says, you two have a love scene in 2 weeks. We're like, well, all right, here
okay.
we go. And that's the way it works. There's a lot of surprises, a lot of like, we can only give you so much information, so you don't play this or that, and here's how it's going to go, this is all the information you need, go with it. So it's, you know, and Cassie is such a natural, she's a master of the genre, she really, really is. She was there for me when we first started hooking up, just helping me, you know, sort of understand the needs of this genre. You know, you're talking about film and the differences, and I was talking about how pictures tell the story. This soaps are a little closer to theater in that it's kind of live. You know, it may be a month ago we taped it, but it was, we were talking about before, you get one take. So it was nice
sure.
to have such a mentor and a master to have those amazing love scenes with. And then, you know, the real relationship is blooming too, which is,
and I would imagine in some ways it's even scarier than real theater, because in real theater you get much more rehearsal than you get now.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, don't even get me started on the lack of rehearsal. That's what they pay us to show up for. So, but no, Cassie's a dream. She's a dream.
Yeah, I know. Well, I saw it, but I definitely see it on screen with Eli and Blair. You know,
no question.
They like to be more. You know, it's like they want to have a playful relationship. They want to have a serious relationship. When you get serious, they want to be playful. And Cassie plays off you like when you play off her.
Oh, great! I'm glad that's being communicated. All the way to Texas. That's good. That's good news.
And speaking of leading ladies, you got to play one before this, before One Light to Live. You got to play on a future leading lady over on All My Children, Melissa Claire Egan, playing her abusive husband.
Yeah, I didn't abuse her. I didn't abuse her. I was merely stalking. I think I had a virgin fetish or something like that. No, I never abused Annie. She just, I was glad to be a tool to introduce this wonderful, you know, as you said, future soap star. I'm glad I could help usher in her career. If I can help in any way, I'm happy to oblige. Melissa Claire is great. I couldn't be happier for her. I remember the casting process. I had actually been cast first. I was not privy to the casting process of Annie, but I remember talking to Cameron about it, and he came and said, "Oh man, you're gonna love this girl. She's awesome." You know, and little did we know that the reason he was there to cast her was that it was going to be her first love interest on the show, and that I was going to be an evil bastard. They hired me, for the record, on All My Children, by the way, under the auspices of a good Samaritan with a mysterious past.
Wow.
So I was like, right, sign me up. Because I guarantee you, had they said, you know, internet predator, they wouldn't get a single actor to show up. It was right around the time that my family and I moved back to New Jersey from New York.
Right.
We pretty much settled on staying in this market. And I swear to God, one day we were in the grocery store, and this lady sees me. She's holding her infant in her arms, and she covers her infant to protect her from me. And I could tell she didn't know why. It was just like an instinct. And it was that day I went into the soap, and I'm like, "You got to do something here. I can't do this anymore. You know, I'm scaring parents now." And they said, "Okay, great. And we're going to create a twin brother for you from Ireland." I'm like, "I love it. I love it." And we never saw the guy. So,
So much for that.
Yeah, but no, Melissa Claire, I'm actually going to see her probably in Vegas. I'm sure she's presenting. She's nominated this year too, isn't she? Or was she nominated last year?
She was nominated last year, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to a reunion out west with her. That'll be fun.
It'll be lots of fun. All right, Matt. I know you probably got a call to Wayne Brennan, so I'm going to get on. Matt, thanks for talking to me, and continue success on Light to Live, and hope we'll see a lot more of Blair and Eli. All right, buddy.
Really great talking
to
you. Thanks so much.
Thanks
a lot,
Tony.
Bye. Take care, Brendan. All right, guys.
So talk to me about Elijah. How did this come into your life? How did you get this role? How did this happen?
This was something, let's see, I had just done that play in Pittsburgh, and the economy was in the tank. My wife and I were trying to get pregnant with our second child, and I really needed a job. I really needed to come back and get a TV show. It was sort of, the commercial market had taken a dive, and so this thing came up, and it was just a couple weeks recurring, and it was a lawyer, and I said to myself before I even got the script, I said, I am going to get this job. I'm going to beat all my peers in this city, and it's amazing when, you know, even, who did I get to act with? Some of the people that they can get on these shows, the caliber of actors that I was up against, I'm not bragging, I'm just saying everyone wanted this job. Everyone wants every job that comes up on the soaps. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise, because, you know,
especially now in New York, the way television jobs are leaving the city, I mean, it must be tougher and tougher. I mean, the roles must get more and more coveted.
Absolutely.
No matter what the role is.
Absolutely. You know, and then Guiding Light got canceled, and all those guys were trying to grab the roles that were on As the World Turns. Then As the World Turns gets canceled, and everyone's trying to gather the roles that's on One Life to Live, and All My Children. Then All My Children moves to L.A. I mean, it used to be, as far as I could tell, it was explained to me that if you're on a soap and you chose to do the soap, have a career in soaps, that, yet, you know, you may never win your Oscar, but at least you're going to be employed for the rest of your life, right?
Sure.
On one or another, there were 15 when I was getting into the business, and then year after year, they kept disappearing or what have you. And so that sense of security was also lifted. So it just, you know, it changed the dynamic. It changed the dynamic, made it more competitive. Everyone, you know, people were taking pay cuts. And as a result, I think people are getting better and better. I don't know. It seems to me. But, yeah, so the breakdown came out for Eli. It was Elijah Kent at first. I remember that. And I don't know why they changed from Clark to Kent. But I like the Superman reference. Anyway, I don't know. So I decided I'm going to get this part, and I had this three-piece suit that I'd gotten on some commercial job. It was gorgeous. I'm like, I'm going to wear this three-piece suit. I'm going to just mac this out. And I went in, and I'd been in for Julie Madison, I don't know, half a dozen times before, if not more than that, for various other parts. And she's like, good, Matt, good job, as always, you know, poker face. And then the next day or the next week or something like that was, we didn't even do a screen test. We just went right to Frank Valentini, the executive producer, just went right to his office to audition. And when I got to the callback, it was all, you know, it was the rogues gallery of my competition in the city. They were all there. So I'm like, I really need this job. I really have to get this job. Focus, Matt, focus. And I walked in and, you know, I just convinced Frank right away that I was the guy and got the part and was pleased as punch about it. Didn't think it was going to last. And like I said, that fateful day when Frank came in and said, you have a love scene in 2 weeks, people started coming up and he's like, hey, congratulations, you're going to be here for a while. Wow. Gary Donatelli, one of the directors, he goes, that's great, man. I'm so psyched for you because it's going to be a lot of work. I go, well, what are you, another couple months? He goes, a couple months? We've got another year, year and a half at least for this storyline. So I was like, yeah, I don't have to move to L.A. again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was great.
You know,
yeah, so it just worked out. I think it was a lot of the storyline worked out that Blair happened to need a guy at that point, and I was around, and Ross was already on his crazy train to the bridge there.
Sure.
So, you know, it worked. And, you know, Ron, the writer, the head writer, he's been very cool. You know, he told me early on, he's like, hey, man, you're going to be here for a little while, so we'll see how long it lasts. But I'm having fun, man. I'm having fun.
You know, we see this all the time on soaps. You know, they bring in a new character. They're not really quite sure what they're going to do with him, so they, you know, they play him in, you know, several different storylines and situations and with different characters and just kind of, you know, throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks.
Right.
Talk to me about what goes through an actor's mind when you're in that kind of situation and you don't really know what's coming, and, you know, your training is you're supposed to know and care about the arc of the character and the motivation and all of that. Talk to me about what goes through your mind when you're in the situation where you don't know day-to-day what's going to happen next and what's coming down the pike.
You know, that's kind of the situation that an actor is in all the time anyway, even successful ones, even super wealthy ones. You know, okay, now I've got the money, what's my next part? you know, that's just part of the lifestyle. So you kind of accept it. There's a whole bunch of given circumstances when doing a soap. That happens to be one of them. You just accept it, try to do the best job you can. Don't take anything personally, because it's not, you know. And just hope you focus group well, because that seems to be the new way people keep their jobs. You know? By the time you're on set and you're in costume and you're getting your two takes in, whether or not you're going to be there tomorrow isn't on your mind, you know. It might be on your way home. Oh, gee, I want to be here tomorrow. It's an interesting dynamic. You know, definitely people's attitudes toward me changed, not because anyone was rude or not, but it was because they didn't want to get close or become friends with someone that wouldn't be there the next day.
Absolutely.
You know? And that's tough. That's tough. You know, when that last round of firings went on, you know, you'd run into some of the guys who were leaving in the hall and they saw a couple episodes left or whatever. You're just like, oh, God, I don't know what to say. You know, I dodged a bullet. My character ends up with the hottie on the show and you went, you know, your character went crazy and killed a bunch of people. So sorry, bro. I'm so sorry, but it's going to be great. You're going to get something else real soon, and you truly hope the best. You know, you wish the best for your peers, because it's not a competition. We're all on the same team, just trying to work. You know, just trying to work.
You know, you mentioned the glorious Cassie DePaiva. I mean, this woman, to my eye, is is still, I mean, even though she's been, you know, at the top of her game for decades now, she's still very underrated in terms of her talent and her ability. I mean, talk to me about working with her.
I agree with you. I'm actually surprised she's not she doesn't have a shelf full of Emmys, but I don't really understand the Emmy process yet. I still consider myself new. But you know, she is just like anyone else. She wants good stories. She yearns for it. This is what she does. You know, this is how she supports her family. And you know, it's she's just such a. But all of those desires and all of those you know, goals for her completely evaporate when she's in front of the camera, because she just becomes Blair. And she's very conscious of the difference between Cassie and Blair. She'll very often say, well, Blair wouldn't do that. I would do that, but Blair wouldn't do that, you know, or vice versa, you know. So it's great to watch. She's just such a pro. Oftentimes I will, you know, be up on my lines or, you know, or mess up my blocking. And you can see, I'll look at Cassie, and she's not frustrated or anything, but I so want to impress her, and I so want to, you know, make her proud and make her psyched to be working with me, that, you know, I get a little bit out of shape if I screw up. I, you know, I have to apologize, Cass. I'm so sorry. I just the other day I was saying this. I take this very seriously. I want you to know. You know, she's like, of course, of course. And so she's been nothing but sweet, nothing but wonderful. And I'm just, I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in soaps, and people tell me as much, so I'm beside myself, really. She's the best.
Tell me what kind of feedback you get from fans. Do you get recognized on the street? Do you get Facebook messages or emails or fan letters? Talk to me about how people regard you when they run into you or when they contact you.
Facebook has definitely opened the doors in a lot of ways for a lot of people.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It really, you know, the first month I discovered it was like a time machine. You know, it was literally like a time machine. I could find out what happened to everyone I ever dated, you know, and everyone I ever hung out with in my living room with photographic evidence, you know. So as such, the fans of the show can reach the actors that way. And it's... Oh my God! Since I've been on the show, it's, you know, a dozen friend requests a day, you know, just purely from the soap. So that's cool, you know, to talk to Tony and just know that whatever you're doing here and on 66th Street in New York is going across the country, and
damn right,
what people care about is it's such a privilege, you know, it's just an honor. But we do get a lot of fans who come to the studio. They're just thrilled to be there. They're thrilled to see you. And what's so cool about being a soap fan is it's a niche, you know. It's one part of the big kaleidoscope of entertainment. So you can kind of own it, you know. It's kind of your thing. If you're a soap fan, that's my thing. People, you know, was like, oh, you're a soap fan. Yes, I am a soap fan, and this is my world, and I am privy to it. I have access to it because the actors – and the fans have a chance to interact all the time. There's fan club events. There's, you know, the soap fans. We need our audience more than ever, so we want to keep them. You know, we
sure
want to make them happy. And they're just the, you know, the most dedicated fans I've certainly ever encountered, you know, of the entire world of soaps.
No question about
it.
You
know, you don't meet a lot of fans who say only watch your soap. They'll tell you that. Oh, I only watch yours. Yours is my favorite. But you know,
yeah,
that, you know, they're TiVoing the rest, you know. So,
damn right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, when, you know, they're just happy to have a conversation about that, you know. a lot of times, like, oh, I hated you on All My Children. I love you on One Life to Live, you know. So.
And I caught you on Guiding Light as well, so.
That's right. Did it, yeah, a couple days on Guiding Light. That was fun. It's cool. I mean, even things like this, you know, this is I'm assuming a show dedicated to soap fans, right? The Star, the one that we're doing.
Sure.
You don't hear, maybe there's like a, you know, a CSI radio show for CSI fans. I don't think so, you know. I don't know. Maybe
exactly.
If I ever get on CSI, I'll find out.
Exactly.
The fans keep us afloat. they do. I mean, if
well,
they
speaking of fans,
watching,
let's go back to the phones and chat with a couple more of them. How about that?
Please.
How about area code 616? This is my buddy John, I believe. John, is that you?
Yes, it is, Brandon. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good, good. Hey, Matt,
yeah,
how
Matt,
are you?
He's right here.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. I just want to say that one of the first things I ever saw you in was a movie called 200 American, which I loved. So
thank you.
That was a great film. I kind of want to know, because I know while you were doing One Life to Live, you did a one-day stint on As the World Turns with Colleen Zink-Pinter. What was that like? It looked fun.
It was pure, yeah, it was fun. I had known the casting director, Mary Clay Boland, who cast the day players on that show. I've known her for years, and she was off to Florida and had this little part that she needed to cast, and she just called my agent and said, you know, would Matt do this? Is he, you know, I know he's on One Life to Live, but he's not on contract. He can do this. Would he do this for me? And I was like, this show's going off the air. I would love to do it for you. Julianne Moore's going to be on the show? Please, I'm there in a minute, you know. No one thought it was a big deal. And I just went down. It was a character thing, so I wasn't even playing anyone similar to Eli in any way. So, it was just a day of work in New York. And then, of course, Soap Opera Digest got wind of it and made a huge story out of it. And, at that point, one life away. What are you doing? You're not on As the World Turns, are you? I'm like, no. It was one day. It was 15 minutes. It was a joke. It's over. Oh, you know, I hope I didn't screw anything up. Like, no.
Well, how does that work, though, when you're not on contract as opposed to being on contract? Because I never really understood the whole recurring versus contract thing.
Gotcha. When you're on contract, what you're doing is you're saying to the soap opera that my schedule is in your hands. You sign away certainly there are exceptions, but basically if the soap needs you, you have to be there. Whereas in recurring status, it's based on the actor's availability. That's the only difference. And there's, a pay difference, but that's neither here nor there. It's literally who gets to own your time, basically. Does that
so
make
do
sense?
You prefer? Do you prefer? Yes. Do you prefer recurring then, or would you want a contract?
Right this minute, the recurring is working for me because of my commercial works. The Old Navy campaign and this cable campaign I have in New York. It just keeps me so busy that the recurring status was great. I'll tell you, had they asked me a month before, or if they asked me in 3 months, absolutely. It was a timing thing, and it's all good. It's all good.
Well, that's good. I'm glad they kept the character on, because I was kind of wondering what they were going to do after the whole Ross thing. But I'm glad.
Yeah, I mean, what's nice about the management at the soap is that you can have personal conversations. You can say, look, I like it here. I'd love to stay. Just so you know, I'm into this. And they take that into account, if your story's working. So, yeah, I had no idea how it was going to go, and neither did Michael Lowry. We were both just thrilled to have a job, and so we tried to make the most of it. It was just sheer luck that he got killed and I didn't. I guess.
Well, thank you for taking my questions. Well, that's about it. I want to get you on to your next caller, so I'm not taking up too much time. But thanks, Brandon, and thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. All right, thanks.
Thanks, John. How about area code 423? You're on the line with Matt Walton.
Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Hi, what's your name?
I saw Cassie on Saturday down in Nashville.
She's been traveling.
Down in Nashville on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And she gushed about you.
Oh, God bless her.
She said that Eli was not Blair's love interest. He was her sex interest.
Yes. Well, okay. Well, I'll take
it.
Hey,
I was just wondering if there are any actors that you haven't worked with a lot on the show that you would like to work more with.
That's a great question. I have not been woven into Christian and Layla's storyline much at all, and I've enjoyed their company very much, and I would love to work with them a little bit more. I'd love to get more work with Robert Woods. I remember when I was young, my father would come home for lunch, and we would all gather around and watch Asa and Bo Buchanan go at it on One Life to Live. And so my first day on the show representing Bo was just, it was like a dream come true for me. It was so bizarre. I really couldn't believe I was there. So I'd love to work with Bob Woods. He's a terrific, terrific actor. And it turns out his wife is friends with my wife from an acting class. So we're going to try to get that together on a personal level. But who else on the show have I not? I've been pretty much intertwined with every character. I've represented most of the town by now.
Sure. It's great to be a lawyer on a soap because sooner or later you'll come in contact with everybody.
Yeah. It's like the cops, you know. Eventually they're going to arrest everybody or have to take everyone to the hospital. Here's what I would like, honestly. I would like to have more scenes with the Kramer family and the Kramer kids, or the Manning kids, as it were. I would like to see how that dynamic fleshes itself out with the budding relationship of Blair and Eli, how he interacts with the kids, and, you know, even, I mean, I've represented Dorian and had some fun with her. She's Robin's genius. I'd like to work with the kids. I guess that's my best answer. And Danielle again. I'd like to be in her life, too, now that you're asking. Because I was just saying the other day that I still consider her a niece, you know, so that'd be nice.
Yeah, I'm hoping they don't kill off Taya.
We're all hoping
they find a cure.
We're all hoping that.
Stupid, would they?
I can't imagine. I can't imagine. I mean, but there may be some, you know, there may be something between the actors and the producer. I don't know. It's none of my business, you know. Florencia may have a big movie deal in her future. I don't.
Okay, yes. Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, I've heard more than one actor say that working with Robin Strasser is a trip because you never quite know what's going to happen. Have you found that to be the case?
Absolutely. But she is such a master of the craft, of soap opera acting. She is... what she and Tuck Watkins, and you know, what they are able to do with their characters and the world of soaps, sort of comment on it, at the same time be utterly convincing as their characters. It's great. And Robin, she's one of the matriarchs on the show, and you know, she gets treated very well, and she deserves all the respect that she gets. You know, she's what's great is it does keep you on your toes. It keeps you active in the moment because she is completely impulsive, as it should be, as acting should be, and she's inspiring. You know, I definitely look up to her. You know,
sure.
It's every time we work together, it's a blast. It's a blast. And she keeps the show on track. She doesn't let stuff slide in any way, even in actors' performances, you know, she won't let the bell ring in the wrong way, you know, the tone strikes exactly how it's supposed to.
Absolutely.
And people defer to her wisdom on it, you know. Yeah, she's great.
You know, you broached this earlier, and you know, whatever you don't want to say about it, you don't have to say about it. But it's no secret that One Life has been going through a, shall we say, interesting time the past few months with, you know, some serious cast changes and a major renovation of the canvas and, the characters and stories. When you see something like that take place and you're right in the middle of it, what goes through your mind? I mean, do you get nervous and start looking around and wondering who's next? I mean, what happens to an actor in that kind of situation?
No, I mean, we're all kind of rooting for the show to do well. So, you know, again, you just accept the sort of changes that come because... it's not up to you, you know, it's up to the audience. And the changes happen because the audience wants to see the show go a certain way. I think that's how it works. Again, the actors are the low men on the totem pole, so we were often not privy to why things happen the way they do. I think people are more concerned about the soaps in general and how they're disappearing than
sure.
about how, you know, how our show is, or why, or the ins and outs of why our show are keeping some people and not keeping others. You know, that's, The grand plan is more ratings, more viewers. You know, keep the show on the air, keep this thing going. You know, that's the goal. So I think people, you know, stand and you know get in lockstep with that goal, and we try to reach it together. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, there's a woman in the chat room named Di, and she's a great friend of this show, this program, and she's telling me to tell you thank you for coming to the PAWS event, I guess, in New York City last month or a couple months ago even. Talk to me about doing events like this with your quote-unquote newfound celebrity. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but, you know, is it fun for you to go out to these events now that you have achieved a certain degree of notoriety and fame?
Well, you know what's interesting is... It's kind of cooler than being at a normal party where people may not know you or the show you're on. There's an automatic ice breaking that goes on because, hey, you know, it's Eli. Hey, Eli, hey, you know, how's it going? And so it, you know.
And because you're in people's living rooms 5 full days a week, people must feel like they know you.
There is an element of that. There is an element of that, but I don't. You know, I used to, when I was watching the reruns of Friends, you know, with my wife, when we were just boyfriend and girlfriend, it would feel as if they lived in the apartment down the hall from us. You know, we watched them every night at 11
uh-huh.
o'clock, and so
uh-huh.
I get that feeling. You know, you want to sort of say, I have an intimate relationship with you personally, even though the person I have that relationship with is a character on a TV show. That said, people get the metaphor, you know, like the woman in the grocery store, she didn't know why she was doing that, you know, but it was because that was in her life, and this face was on her mind, in her subconscious, you know, that produced that reaction. On the positive side, you know, at events like this, people are just like, hey, love your thing, love your commercials, great, where are you from, what's your name, that's, you know. Can I take a picture? Absolutely. Let's have some fun. You know, it's people, unlike a party where you don't know people, you have that icebreaker, and everybody there wants to be there. That kind of dynamic you can't buy. You know, when dozens of people are in the same room because they want to be, you know, that's the recipe for fun. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so the fan events are great. I'd like to do more of them. I wish there were more soap cruises and Disneyland soap days and all that stuff. Got to get everybody rallied and together and make these things happen.
You know, I haven't aired it yet, but I taped an episode of my own show last week with a terrific guy by the name of Mark Dobies, who used to be on Guiding Light and One Life 100 years ago, and he's formed his own company called Shake the Tree, and I understand that you're working on a project with him. What can you tell us about that?
I got a few projects in the hopper with Mark Dobies. We were
fantastic.
We were brought together. We have the same agent, as it turns out.
Okay.
We did until a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago. So he was. I approached his partner with a script that a friend of mine had approached me with, because I had worked with his partner before, a girl named Tony D'Antonio, on a commercial. And she, you know, she ran the tightest ship I had ever seen on a shoot. So I had heard that she had a production company somehow, and this guy gave me this script that I thought was worthy of production. I said, you know, I'd love to direct this thing. I think it's a kind of a screwball comedy about Facebook and that kind of thing. And I think I get this. I'd like to try my. I've always wanted to be a director, and this was, of course, before One Life to Live. So I was really looking for a job, any job. And so I approached Tony with this script. She loved it. She showed her partner, Mark Dobies. He loved it. Mark and I became friends, and we're raising the money for it right now. It's we don't know when it's going to go, when it's going to happen, but while they're raising money for a couple other projects, I have brought another script to Mark another friend of mine has come up with, and so these things are all in development. It's kind of hush hush, but we're really excited. I mean, again, this is part of being the New York actor. You have to diversify, and if
sure.
one market is drying up, you've got to throw your hat in the ring of another.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're doing. You got to make your own work, as they say.
You know, I was talking to him about this, about the Shake the Tree umbrella, as it were, and you know, his enthusiasm for the whole process was so infectious that, You know, you just want to see 10 movies come out of this company immediately because,
yeah,
you know, the way he talks about it, he's like a little kid. He's so excited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's what that, and that kind of energy can get things done. You know what I mean? That kind of energy, like you said, is infectious. And, you know, he's going to, together or however it works out, stuff will happen. Stuff will happen. Yeah, he's a great dude. He's a great dude. I remember we were at the we're at a point where the script was about to be sold, but needed to be retooled, and you know, we couldn't get to the writer, or the writer didn't want to retool it the way it needed to be retooled for this particular financier, and so Mark and I were on the phone. He's like, "All right, Matt, you know what? I'm just gonna rewrite it. I'm just gonna do it. I got it. What do you need? Tell me what you need in this to make this make sense, and I'm gonna rewrite it." And overnight, he had rewritten the script and presented it to the financier, and the financier said,
"Oh my God, he
fixed it." You know, so he's into it, and like, you know, that you need to be. You need to have an endless amount of energy to get something done in this country anymore. You know, you really do. You really do. That's cool. You talk to Mark. I have to tell
absolutely. Him. Like I said, I haven't aired the show yet, and it's so funny that you've got his voice down exactly. I mean, he sounds exactly like that, especially when he's excited and you're talking about something that he's interested in. It's very, very funny. I'm still editing.
Come on, Matt. You got to give me that script, man. I want to talk to you about that script, man. You know, it's
great. You got it exactly right.
It's great. I saw him at the Paz event. I was leaving as he was coming in. I was bummed I didn't get to spend some time with him.
Wow. Well, I tell you what. Let's take another phone call. How about that?
Great.
Area code 781. You're on the line with Matt Walton. 781. Okay.
I'm trying to guess the area codes, too. Is that Minnesota?
Okay, 781, you're off the air with Matt Walton. Sorry.
781, so long.
So, you know, the chat room is all abuzz, and the message boards are all lit up talking about your Old Navy ads, this new round of commercials that's pulling across the country. How did this come about?
Quite suddenly, as a matter of fact. We were shooting, what was it? Some scene where I need... Oh, New Year's Eve scenes. Was that what it was? No, that couldn't be. When was... Why else would we have been in a tuxedo lately? I don't know, but in a tuxedo and needed to be in a tuxedo for this audition.
Okay.
And I was literally shooting the show, and my agent's like, "You got to make this audition. This is your part." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I've heard that before." All right, well, you know, I'm in a tux. They're like, "Perfect, you need to be in a tux." So I snuck out of the studio and got in a cab and went and auditioned for this thing in the tux and came back. And, you know, by the end of the week, I had gone in again. I was actually up against it with Rob Bogue of Guiding Light. He and I are often of the similar parts. And I thought for sure it was going to go to him. I thought it was perfect. But it fell in my lap, literally last minute. And there was a scene where Eli was supposed to be representing Cole and was inexplicably not there. It's because I had to fly to L.A. to shoot the first round of those commercials, and One Life to Live was so gracious to you know, rearrange the schedule for that day, because, you know, I kind of left them in the lurch, you know, with having to fly out of there. But, you know, this is one of those things, like, okay, well, you go do a commercial and you'll get back and it'll run for 13 weeks and then it's done. Well, this thing turned into this whole big campaign, and, you know, there's a new sale every week, and I'm out in L.A. once a month shooting four spots at a time, and I'm voicing them. You know, they're 15-second commercials, and it's the same ad agency that did the Burger King King, you know, that crazy character. So it's that kind of unnerving, kooky kind of character.
Absolutely. Those Burger King commercials are hilarious.
They're great. So what makes...
so bent.
Comedy funny is the music of it. So you have to get the music of these Old Navy commercials just right in 15 seconds. So we'll shoot the whole thing, and they'll edit it together how they want. And then I go back into the studio once, maybe twice, and revoice all the stuff to make it sort of that perfect commercial song, that 15-second song. I call it a song because it's just highs and lows and rhythms and all this kind of thing. So it's keeping me so busy. You know, it's been a challenge. It's a welcome challenge, believe me. But I was pretty sure that this summer was going to be easy breezy, One Life to Live, and it's anything but easy. But
lo and behold,
I'm thrilled. I think it has the potential to be, you know, one of those, I hesitate to say this, but iconic spots like the Burger King King, assuming it runs long enough and doesn't, you know, get under anyone's skin too much. I'm trying to keep it, you know, trying to keep it fun, trying to keep it funny. But, that's just a blessing. It really, I'm humbled by it, really, because it's...
Well, and it's funny because Old Navy has a history of that. I mean, they did a series of commercials years ago with Morgan Fairchild, I believe, and they ran for years and years and years.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I mean, they definitely hire some creative people to make their commercials, and the commercials become memorable. So here's hoping.
You know, it's none of my business at all, and I won't ask you for specific numbers, but my understanding is that commercials like this can be extremely lucrative. Is that true?
They certainly can be. Certainly ones that run a long time with characters that are in it for a long time. The classic example is the Verizon guy. You know, he has a theater company in New York, and he produces whatever plays he wants because he's the Verizon guy, and
wow.
He's not going to be really seen for a while, so he may as well do what he wants to do, and he's able to do that, and it's fantastic. Now, he'll be fine. He'll take off the glasses and let his hair go gray, and in 3 years, people won't really even remember that that's him. And you know what? He probably never has to work again. That said, money isn't everything, and I'm sure he can't wait to get back to work.
Absolutely.
So, yes, commercials can be very lucrative. They just have to run a long time before that happens. And back in the 80s, when there were only three networks, commercials were ridiculously lucrative. I mean, Joe Piscopo made millions, you know, because, you know, Lowenbrow only had to advertise on three channels. So it reached so many more, each commercial reached so many more people.
Uh-huh.
These days, they reach less and less people with the Internet taking viewers away and TiVo allowing people to skip commercials altogether. Advertisers are, you know, cutting back on the exorbitant salaries to their talent because it just costs too much money. So, you know, fingers crossed. I'm not starving, but, it ain't the stuff of legend yet. Put it that way.
You know, I watch TV, and I look at people like this woman who does the Progressive ads, for Progressive Insurance, or the kid who did the Dell ads years ago. What was the name, Steven? You know, these people must be set for life.
Unfortunately, the Dell kid ran into some legal trouble.
Yes, he did.
So I heard some sad story about that poor guy. He was. Oh, somebody saw him working somewhere that was just devastating. Now the Progressive girl. Now you'd think she'd have her own sitcom by now.
You bet,
because
she is hilarious. Her timing is impeccable.
Yeah, you know she's just quirky enough. And usually when people have a commercial like that where they're themselves or, you know, they're making a great character like that, those characters tend to appear on sitcoms. I guess there are less and less sitcoms being produced every year, so that takes away. But I'm surprised she hasn't. Taken off in prime time. Maybe she shot a pilot this year. I don't know. I'm sure, you know, she's at the point now. It's, what are we talking, 3 years of that, of her, maybe? Two or three? I'm sure she's doing very well right now. She's doing very well right now. But now, the Apple, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, guys.
Uh-huh.
The legend is, of their salaries is truly the stuff of legend. Apparently. I don't know if it's true. But those are the two most successful commercial actors of our time, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, hey, it's Apple. I mean, they're the biggest company on the planet, basically.
Pretty much.
So there is a chorus of screams and chants in the chat room for you to do the growl. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you if you want to do the growl for the people in the chat room.
Hey, rawr, that one.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a throwaway take, interestingly enough. I was totally goofing off on that take, and they put it in the commercial. And not only did they put it in the commercial, they said, you're going to be doing this in a lot of commercials, just so you know. This is going to be one of the Mike's things. I'm like, oh great. In fact, I was on vacation in Florida when that commercial was about to air, and I had to go to a recording studio to sweeten the voice, and the engineers came out laughing, like, hey, Tiger. I'm like, what? They're like, you haven't seen the spot yet? I go, no. Like, come in here, look. And, you know, 5 seconds in, I'm scratching the lens and growling like a panther at the camera. I'm like, oh, they used that. Wow. Wow. Wow, didn't see that one coming. But I was like, I see the direction they want. That's real-time feedback right there. You know,
absolutely.
You see the direction they want to go with the characters. So you're like, okay.
And now that's the thing that everybody's crazy about.
I know. That's so funny. That's, now, in the Spanish language version, there's a guy who I do say the words in Spanish, but then they hire a guy to say it better or the way Spanish people would actually like to hear it. And that guy's growl was like this. It was so low and crazy. I wish I had. It's got to be on YouTube somewhere. I'll try to post it if I can. I'll ask the ad agency to put it up. Because people who like that commercial will love the Spanish version. The overdub is hilarious.
Wow.
Hilarious. Yeah, a little showbiz. Sorry, get some information there.
Let's try it. Area code 781. One more time. You got your hand raised. Area code 781. You're on the line with Matt Walton.
Hello?
Hello.
Success.
Hello,
781. I lost you last time.
Oh,
hello.
What's your name?
Jackie.
Hi.
Hello.
What's your question, Jackie? What do you got?
I was just wondering, like, what was probably your favorite scene that you shot so far on the show? If someone already hasn't asked it, I just tuned in.
Ooh, that's another good question.
Absolutely.
Wow. Favorite scene I shot on the show. I do enjoy the courtroom scenes where I end up monologuing, winning the case. Those are fun because, you know, as I said before, I grew up, my father was a lawyer, and I never was really privy to see him perform. I never saw him do his thing in court. So it was, I kind of imagined how he would be if he were, you know, delivering the dissertation or whatever he had to say. So some of the, I'm trying to think of the latest courtroom scenes, but the one where I don't know, has this aired yet, where I say Cole Thornhart was arrested. Meanwhile, he's arrested without bail. Meanwhile, Todd Manning, who is currently suspected for murdering someone, he walks his way as a free man. You know, those kinds of great speeches are just, they're so much fun. I'm trying to think if there's been any other scenes. Certainly the ones with Ross. I guess the fight scene with Ross, where Ross punches me out. The fight scenes are a blast. And Lowry was, man, you thought Robin Strasser throws you for a loop. Michael Lowry, you don't know what he's going to do, you know. So I really hope they bring him back. I would love to work with him again and create some more havoc with Ross. That would be great. I was bummed I didn't get to do the bridge scene. I figured Eli could, you know, at least see his brother get killed.
Sure.
Yeah, no, they wouldn't give it to me. So that was, I think the courtroom would be my favorite. But that was a great question.
That's cool.
Yeah. What was your favorite? What's been your favorite? I skipped right over the Cassie sex scenes out of respect for my co-star, but I certainly enjoy doing those, so for what that's worth.
Those are pretty funny.
Yeah, those are good. Those are fun.
Yeah, they're pretty
good.
We
were both so nervous doing those. You know, it happened so suddenly, and they were so intense for daytime that, you know, we were trying to find our footing, you know, in the characters with those scenes, so. You know, a lot of that stuff we just had to let fly, you know, to see what would happen.
I'll tell you the one I loved was one where you guys were in the hotel and going at it, shall we say, and Renee knocks on the door and interrupts you guys, and you have to kind of fumble your way through a very awkward conversation with her.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun. she was giving me a lot to play off of, too. You know, it's always fun being funny. It certainly is always fun being funny. Soaps, you don't get that opportunity now.
Absolutely, it's all
strong. That's why we're all jealous of Tuck and Robin. They get all the funny lines, you know what I mean? So, yeah, that was cool. That was cool.
What else you got, Jackie?
Well, thank you.
All right, Jackie, thank you very much.
Thank you for answering my question, and
sure.
Hope to see more of you on the show.
I appreciate it. Take care of yourself.
You too.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks, Jackie. How about area code 626? You're on the line with Matt Walton. Say hi.
Hello.
Hello.
First, I want to say I love Eli and Blair so much. They make me laugh a lot.
Yeah, good.
Well, they're my second favorite because I love Todd and Tiff so much.
Hey,
but
we're
getting up there. And my question is, what storyline do you want for your character?
Good, huh? You guys are asking the best questions here. Let's see. More than anything, I would love to know my history. I would love to know the Book of Eli. You know, I don't know why he has a different name, last name than his brother. I'd love to know that. I don't know, you know, whatever became of Ross, why they never found his body. I'd love to examine that. You know, as a lawyer, I'm you know, I'd love to find out, you know, what really went down on that bridge, because I wasn't there, you know. I'd love to find out. I'd love to get married to Cassie DePava. You know, that would be
great. I was hoping when that aired and, like, Eli was talking about marriage, I was like, see, yes, see, yes. Like, I was, like, screaming. I wanted that.
I would love to get married on a soap opera. That'd be great. That would be great. So, I don't know. Yeah, find out why I'm there, who I am, and to start a future in Landview. That's the storyline I want.
Yeah, and get some family other than Ross.
That'd be nice. Do you have any ideas, too, as to where you'd like to see the story go?
Not really, sure. Other than him marry Blair, nothing really. Yeah, well, him, like, officially meet her kids.
Right, like we were saying before, interact with the kids. I'm great with kids. I think Eli could be great with kids.
Especially Star, since they're, like, really close.
Yeah, you know, and this, you know, that I, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Star and I have not interacted, I don't think, one time.
Yeah, and maybe have a fight with Todd, because that'd be hot.
That would be fun. That would be fun. Trevor and I would have a great time with that. That would be a hoot. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I like
your
idea.
Well, it was nice talking to you.
Thanks. I'm going to bring your ideas to the writers tomorrow and see if they'll put them in, okay?
Absolutely.
All right. Awesome.
Thanks. Thanks for calling.
Bye. You're welcome. Bye.
You know, you mentioned not having a lot of backstory or a lot of information at your disposal, but just for your own purposes as an actor, I mean, do you kind of create your own backstory to kind of salt and pepper the scenes and give them a little more context, a little more trace elements, as it were?
You figure out enough to get you through the scene. You know, you're like, okay, well, if I don't know what I'm doing, I better have a reason. And that's actually, that's sort of acting 101. It doesn't, the audience doesn't have to know the reason you're doing something, as long as you know the reason you're doing something. So that's part of the frustration and part of the enjoyment and the challenge is, you know, usually you have a very clear set of given circumstances. And there's a, you know, you see a beginning, middle, and end, and where this particular event fits into the storyline. In the soap, it's a never-ending storyline, so you don't know, there is no end. I have no beginning, you know, and most characters' beginnings are hazy or, you know, hidden, and so you only have this moment. So you try to make the moment work. You can't play one side or the other because you don't want to give anything away, and the writers haven't decided what exactly you mean by that anyway, you know, so it's a challenge, but it's definitely, it's unique, and that is something that actors are definitely seeking all the time, a unique,
absolutely,
one-of-a-kind experience. You know what I mean?
I saw a great actor named James Woods on Inside the Actor's Studio years ago, and he said pretty much exactly that. I mean, he said, you know, basically as an actor, you have to believe that you are the hero of your own story, even if you only have three lines in a scene or whatever. And, you know, the way you do that is by coming in with your own backstory, with your own work, with your own preparation, with your own context. And, you know, just as you said, the audience doesn't have to know, the director doesn't have to know, nobody has to, the co-star doesn't have to know. But if you know, it makes your performance that much more believable, that much more credible.
Right. The other side of that story is Harrison Ford, you know, was being interviewed by an agent or something in his early career, and the agent said, now look at this. Look at that guy, the bellhop there.
Now that you know what I see, you know what people are supposed to see there, an actor. That is a star. And Harrison Ford says, "Really? I thought I was supposed to see a bellboy." You know, so yeah, James Woods. Yeah, it's easy for James Woods to say he's the star of his world, but I would hesitate to put too much stock into a three-line part because really. In television film, that is an element of the story. You know what I mean? And so it's your job to tell the story. And if the story is the bellhop is there to deliver information, then that's what the bellhop does. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not. This isn't a challenge to James Woods. Believe me. I'm just saying there's two sides of the thought process there.
But I would think, you know, especially for young actors coming up, I would think that the way you learn how to, put your training to work, as it were, or, you know, put the things you learn into a real-world application is by doing exactly that, by, you know, pretending that you are the most important person in the story, even if you only have three lines.
Right.
I mean, I would think that would be a sure road to getting to leading man status.
There you go. See, now that, I wasn't trying to suggest that you shouldn't try.
Sure.
To say your three lines, but you do need to know your character's place in it, and so you take the three line part and you let that story be told, and you are part of the fabric of that story. You are a stitch in the fabric of that story, and you hope that you become a line of stitches in the fabric of that story, and then you hope you become a square on the quilt of the fabric of that story, and then you hope you become the whole damn blanket. You know what I mean? So that's. If that's what you're getting at, then I smell what you're stepping in. Because I think that's what we're doing. Yeah.
So, in preparation of speaking with you tonight, I noticed on your filmography on IMDb that you've done some extensive voiceover work for more than one video game, and these must have been fascinating experiences for you.
Video games. It's one of the more frustrating jobs in entertainment right now because the video games make more money than many of the movies. Yet the actor gets. One day rate for their work.
Wow.
Now, you may think, all right, well, you're paid one time to talk. Only with video games, you don't talk. You die 1,000 ways, or you kill someone 1,000 ways. Literally, you destroy your instrument going in there and doing a day's worth of video games. I haven't voiced any video games where people aren't crashing cars or killing each other or shooting each other, you know what I mean? So it's all like, and then, you know, you get the craziest direction. Okay, so a guy is choking you to death with a beer bottle, shoving it down your throat. How would that sound? Go, give it to me, you know, and you'd be like, you know, you just try to imagine. So, yeah, it's fun for about 10 minutes. 6 hours of it is grueling. It's grueling, and you have no voice the next day. That said, it's awesome when your nephew is playing the game and, you know, you are the voice of him killing the guys or, you know, or you're the voice of his victim getting killed or whatever. And he's like, yeah, that's my uncle right there. You know, that's nice. Beyond that, video games, they need to restructure the whole the video game system because these things make so much money and the actors get paid nothing.
Okay.
Nothing. It's
you know,
weird.
Funny enough, in my misspent youth, I used to date somebody who actually designs video games, and he would show me these things and try to explain them to me, and, you know, my mind, it just doesn't work in that world. Anything more complex than say, Sonic the Hedgehog or Super Mario World, and I'm just flummoxed, but,
right.
You know, these video games nowadays, they're more convoluted and more detailed than most movies are these days, and it's truly incredible. I mean...
It is. It's such a lucrative aspect of entertainment, and, you know, it's... I remember when we were kids, there was a video game called Dragon's Lair, where it was animated, and it was the first sort of, virtual reality game. And so, I mean, all the gaming, as popular as it is, I mean, that says something about a society where people have that much free time. I don't, certainly. And for me, playing video games is the ultimate waste of time. You know, watching TV or the History Channel or something, at least you're learning.
Yeah.
If I'm playing a video game, it is negative time. I'm just throwing time away, you know. But that's just me. I know they're very popular, and they're certainly
awesome to watch. I love watching people play video games because it is kind of like being in a movie where, you know, you can't predict how it's going to end. That's
yeah,
kind of fun.
And you're the character in the movie.
That's right. There's one video game that there's, I don't know, it's like the rest of them, I guess, but there's a particular fan of the game who has contacted me several times, insistent upon the fact that I play the part in the film version of the video game because he thinks I look exactly like the character and talk exactly like the character.
Wow.
He has his campaign to, like, make sure I play that part. I'm like, dude, I got to be as famous as Mark Wahlberg before that's going to start happening, you know what I mean? So, thanks. Keep a good thought, you know, tell the creators. That would be great. But, that's where the actors really get to do their work is when the video game becomes a movie. Then, you know, then it creates a whole buzz. That's cool. That's
sure.
Cool.
So are there such things as residuals or royalties for these video games, or is it like
no,
you say, you go in for 1 day or 2 days and you're done?
You go in, you destroy your instrument, they pay you a little bit of money, and you're done. That's it.
Wow.
And you watch the video game make $1 billion.
You bet.
Awesome. Awesome. In fact, I ended up voicing, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, I ended up voicing the last Grand Theft Auto, but they didn't tell us it was Grand Theft Auto. They told us it was something else. And we were, I not only voiced it, but I did motion capture where you put on the skin tight suit with all the little orbs of light and they, you know, then they digitally animate the way you moved into the game.
Holy
but they called it like, you know, Night Racer 3 or whatever, and it turns out to be the new Grand Theft Auto. They won't even tell
there's
the
no
talent.
Way to figure it out.
Right, it's so people so want to know what the next video game is going to be. So it's that security is that tight that we didn't even know what we were doing. Because I think had we known we were doing Grand Theft Auto, we'd have asked for more money. You know, we'd have demanded more money. So I don't know. It's
wow.
As they say, it ain't show friends, it ain't show family, it's show business.
You've also done a number of audiobooks as well. That must be a total blast to do.
The ones I did were absolutely fun. The Spider-Man and the Sinbad, you know, the kids' books I enjoy. I also did a Danielle Steele, which, you know, God bless Danielle Steele, but that is another, unfortunately, less desirable voiceover job because it takes you 3 days to read a book. If every time you screw up or you mispronounce a word, you have to go back to a sentence. I think you can only do about, 120 pages a day or something like that. So there are people who are great at it and who make a ton of money doing it, and that's their thing, and God bless them. But it's grueling work. You talk about losing your instrument. I mean, that's 3 days of reading aloud, you know, some detective story. It's brutal. It's real work. You know, I don't want to sell it short at all. It's real work.
And so, when you do these things, do you have like a director kind of guiding you, or is it all you? I mean, how does it work when you're recording one of these books?
You have a director, and you have an audio engineer.
Okay.
And you know, you're kind of pressed for time, so there's not a lot of prep work. But you'll be reading along, and, you know, say you'll come across a female character who has dialogue, and you'll put on your best girl voice without trying to sound too much like an idiot, you know. And the director may say, you know what, that sounded a little bit too much like Lila in the last chapter. You got to make Darla sound a lot different than Lila. And I'm like, well, I'm a man. I'm having trouble even making Lila sound like a woman. So, you know, that's where they'll intervene, you know. But otherwise, it's just, nope, you said that wrong, or let's go back. They're pretty much just, you get the job because you've proven yourself as a good reader and, you know, a decent, you know, voice, giver of voices to characters or whatever.
Sure.
So, yeah, once you're underway, it's pretty much just, let's get to the end of this book, you know. To put it bluntly.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll confess, I'm not a huge fan of the audiobooks. I'd rather just pick up a book and read it. But years ago, I listened to Kathy Bates doing the audiobook of Silence of the Lambs, and
well,
you know,
there
it
you
seemed
go.
Like it, I mean, she would do. She went all out too. She did the the creepy Hannibal Lecter voice, and she did all the voices, and it seemed like she was having just the time of her life, and she deserved an Oscar just for that, I thought.
Nice. Yeah, the results are usually good. I mean, no one, you know, I don't want to sound like a kvetcher over here, but, you know, it, ultimately, yeah, you want to entertain people, and you want them to enjoy the book. Like I said, the ones I was lucky enough to do, like Spider-Man, are you kidding me? I used to read those comics. I got to be Dr. Octopus and Spider-Man and the Sandman and tell the story and be the characters. It was, you know, it was just like being a kid again. So, yeah, the key to everything is to find the silver lining, to find the good in it, you know. And it seems to me, I'm not that old, but what I have gleaned in my years is that everything is about as good as it sucks. So if you can pay attention to the good and let the sucky part go by, you're going to be all right. You're going to be all right. That's my 11 p.m. philosophy right there.
You should stitch that on a pillow.
Yeah, I'm about to, actually. Kathy had taught me to crochet, so I'm about to, yeah. Yeah, my mother-in-law watches her crocheting show, and we were talking about that today. Like, oh, yeah, I did that for a season, you know, 10 years ago or 5 years ago on PBS. They just keep rerunning it again and again. And awesome. Awesome.
So what's on the horizon for Matt Walton? What's coming down the pike for you?
I have a new series on Comedy Central coming up.
Okay.
Next year. It's by the writers of the newspaper The Onion. Do you guys get that
sure,
out
yeah,
there?
Yeah, absolutely.
They have been doing some web videos lately, you know, where they'll do a takeoff of a morning show, or they'll do a takeoff of a McLaughlin Group's roundtable, you know, political show.
Uh-huh.
They also did some internet videos, a la Sports Center, you know, where
okay.
you know guys are getting interviewed about the sporting events of the day, and of course it's written by The Onion, so it's hilarious and underhand.
Talk about wicked senses of humor. I mean, these guys.
Wicked
sense.
That's a great way to put it. And so Comedy Central picked up a half-hour series called The Onion Sports Network. And if you're at a bar and the volume is down, you wouldn't know you weren't watching Sports Center on ESPN. But if you turn the volume up, you know you're watching Comedy Central.
Okay.
You know, it looks exactly like Sports Center. You know, it's in essence the Colbert Report of sports.
Okay.
The difference being Colbert is the star of his show. The Onion is the star of our show. The material is the star. You know, we are just the messengers. But it's myself and another guy named Matt Oberg. We're the two anchors. And, yeah.
But, you know, in a way that's great because you've kind of got a built-in audience, and the audience that you'll have is already primed for something that they know they're going to get.
Absolutely. I mean, the difference between, you know, the political shows on Comedy Central and this one is, you know, Jon Stewart's only going to win over half the country, you know. Everyone, on the other hand, loves sports. And I don't think anyone's going to be too sensitive about us making fun of sports because we're having fun making fun of sports. What we're making fun of is how intense the attention paid to sports has become and how, you know, how important sports think they are. That's the crux of the fun part. So yeah, I think our audience is primed and ready for something like this. Where I'm beside myself about it. It's
excellent.
Exactly what I wanted to do. You know, when I saw Jon Stewart doing his thing on The Daily Show during the Bush years, I was like, yeah, man, he's taking his job as an entertainer and he's being responsible with it. He's trying to, you know, educate as well as entertain.
Absolutely.
Know, I that's what I took away from it, and so I aspire to do that—to have some sort of to make people laugh, but also make them think. And I, you know, it may sound arrogant to assume a sports parody can do that, but I think we do. I think we do. And so that's coming out January of next year. Shoots in New York, so I can still do the soap and that at the same time, and I'm planning to do both as long as I can. Oh, and more Old Navy at the same time, of course.
Sure.
Naturally.
So
just had a couple more days. Just had a couple more hours to the day and a couple more days to the week, and I'll squeeze it all in. It's fine.
Well, I'll tell you what. I hope you keep us posted about this Onion Sports thing, and we'd love to bring you back here and to talk just about that whenever it's up on its feet and ready to go.
Let's do it. Let's see how the summer pans out with the show and with Eli. I'd love to come back and talk to you guys.
Absolutely.
This is a blast.
Well, I tell you what, I've had such a great time talking to you. I know you were expecting somebody else, and I appreciate you swimming with the flow here and going with the conversation, and it was a great, great evening, and I hope you had fun too.
I certainly did. I had no expectations one way or the other, so I'm just as happy I got to talk to you as anyone else, my friend. This was great. This was a great chance to meet people, and, you know, Lord, actors' favorite subjects are always themselves, so
sure.
I had no shortage of things to say. I hope I didn't talk your ear off too much.
Not at all.
Good.
Well, I tell you what, before I let you go, could I get you to do a promo for the show?
Sure, I'd love to.
As long as it includes the words Matt Walton and Star Dish Radio, whatever else you say is totally up to you.
Okay, great.
And we're taping now, so whenever you're ready, shoot.
How's it going, everybody? This is Matt Walton on Star Dish Radio. Don't turn your dial or press the keyboard or however you're listening to us right now. Tune in. There's more fun to come. How was
fantastic.
That?
Thank you so
cool.
much, sir.
Hey, man. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The terrific Matt Walton, everybody, on Stardust Radio. Stardust Radio in the can for June 15th, 2010. Again, I am Brandon. Joanne is the normal host. You know that. She's having some trouble with her move to Florida from Buffalo, so she asked me to take the reins. I'm Brandon. I'll give a quick plug for my own show since I have a little bit of time. My show is called Brandon's Buzz. It's on this network. You can find it at blogtalkradio.com/Brandon's Buzz. Last week I talked to the terrific rock legend Meatloaf. That's archived. I've talked to several of Matt Walton's co-stars on One Life to Live, Eileen Kristen, Brett Claywell, David Gregory, David Fumero, all kinds of One Life to Live people. One Life to Live has been my show for 20-plus years, and I love that show, and that's why I had a great time talking to Matt Walton tonight. You can check out my show at several places, blogtalkradio.com/Brandon's Buzz. It's kind of home base for the show. My blog, brandonsbuzz.com, has a full radio archive of all the episodes. There are 62 episodes, I believe, and they're all up at brandonsbuzz.com. I'm on iTunes also as Brandon's Buzz. Just type the words Brandon's Buzz in the iTunes Music Store search box. Scroll down to the podcast section. Click on my logo. From there, you can download it as a podcast. You can also download this show as a podcast from the iTunes Music Store. Just type in Stardust Radio. Scroll down to the podcast section. Click on the logo. And there you go. You've got great podcasts from great guys like Matt Walton and everybody that Joanne's talked to, everybody I've talked to. You can find this show at blogtalkradio.com/Stardish. And if you're listening, you know all that. And if you're not listening, you know how to find it now. So anyway, I thank Joanne. Joanne's a good friend of mine. And like I said, she told me to do this. She asked me to do this, and I told her I'd do it in a second. And I had a great time talking to Matt Walton tonight, and I hope you guys did as well. And I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I want to thank everybody for hanging out in the chat room tonight and everybody who called in and everybody who's listening and everybody who will listen. And I encourage you to check out both Joanne's old shows. All of her shows are archived, and all of mine are as well. Again, my show is called Brandon's Buzz. Just Google the words Brandon's Buzz, Google the words Stardust Radio, and you will find something that points you in both of our directions. And speaking for Joanne, we appreciate you guys coming in our directions and finding us and listening to us. And we hope you continue finding and listening to Brandon's Buzz and to Stardust Radio.
Hi, this is Robin Strasser on Stardust. Let's dish.
If you
Hey, everybody, this is Bob Guinea, and you're listening to Star Dish Radio. Let's dish, baby!
Hey, yo, this is Big Bad Brian DeTillo on Star Dish Radio, giving up the dish and claiming myself as one heck of a star.
Hi, this is Gloria Loring on Stardust Radio.
Hi, this is Marsha Mason, and I'm on Stardust Radio.
Hey, this is Nicholas Rodriguez. You're listening to Stardust Radio. Enjoy, you guys. Have fun.
Hi, this is Tyler Christopher, and you're listening to Stardish Radio.
Hi, this is January Lavoie, better known as Noelle Ortiz, the pie bacon waitress from the Bonjour Cafe, and you are listening to Stardish Radio.
This is Antonio Sabato Jr., and you're listening to Stardish Radio.
Hi, this is Aiden Turner on Stardish Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Brandon Barash, and thank you for listening to Stardish Radio.